It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. We've got a great panel for you. Stephen Levy from Back Channel and Wired Magazine, Georgia Dow from iMore, and Steve Kovac from Business Insider. We're going to talk about the week's tech news, a big tech summit at Trump Tower, and why everybody looks so sour. Steve actually was in the lobby waiting for them to come out. What's going on at Google? Nobody knows better than Stephen Levy. And Georgia Dow will explain why fake news appeals to your lizard mind. It's all coming up next on Twit.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 593, recorded Sunday, December 18th, 2016. Coulrophobia. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Stamps.com. Start using your time more effectively with Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, right from your desk. For our special offer, go to Stamps.com, click the microphone, and enter Twit. And by Squarespace. Squarespace is the simplest way to create a beautiful website. Set your business, portfolio, blog, or wedding apart at squarespace.com. For a free trial and 10% off, be sure to enter the offer code TWIT. And by GoToMeeting. Why just phone conference when you can go high tech? Better meetings start with GoToMeeting. HD video means you'll never miss a thing, and screen sharing keeps everyone on task. Don't phone it in. GoToMeeting. Start your free trial. GoToMeeting.com. And by Audible. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get two free books. Go to audible.com/twit2. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. And I guess this episode will be covering the year's tech news, too, because it's our last show, normal show of 2016. Next week, we'll be doing a holiday episode with Steve Gibson, Denise Howell, and Renee Ritchie. And it'll be a look back at 2016, the top big stories that we talked about in 2016, everything from the exploding Samsung Galaxy Note 7 wow. Was that me making that sound? To why your computer makes strange sounds. Actually, I'm using my new computer for 2017 already. This is the very nice Surface Studio from Microsoft. I'm going to say the computer of the year 2017. The following week, we'll do a best of the January 1st episode, the New Year's. So it's Christmas Day will be the kind of the roundup, and then New Year's Day will be the best of. So there'll be all new podcasts, but I won't have to sit in this seat those days. So we're going to go off and do some holiday things. Meanwhile, for the last show, I thought it'd be fun to bring in some of my favorite people, starting with somebody we haven't seen in a long, long time. Stephen Kovac is here from New York still, yes?
Still in New York.
Senior correspondent to Business Insider. Great to see you and your cat.
He's sitting here next to me.
I know. Aw, that's nice. Welcome. I haven't seen you in ages.
I think it's... Here's Larry.
Here's Larry. Hi, Larry. Hey, Larry. Hi, Larry.
Yeah, it's been... I think I was on in October, maybe?
Yeah, well, welcome back.
Yeah.
It's nice
to see
you.
Good to be back.
Also joining us from Back Channel, Stephen Levy is here. One of the great tech journalists of all time, StephenLevy.com. He's got a lovely Christmas tree behind him. Very festive. Hi, Stephen. Good to have you.
Yep.
And
good to be here.
From Montreal, Canada, it's Georgia Dow of iMore.com. Hi, Georgia.
Hey. Hey, thanks for having me again.
You're in the white room today.
I'm in the white room, you know, the padded.
Johnny Ive padded cell. You were not in the room where it happens, however, this week. On Wednesday, neither was Jack Dorsey, though, so don't feel too bad. On Wednesday, President-elect Trump met with the tech titans, everybody above the billionaire line, except Jack Dorsey, in Trump Tower. And I love the pictures of Tim Cook, who went along with Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. And there was some debate over whether these guys should go, Sheryl Sandberg, Safra Katz of Oracle, or whether they should stay at home. Mark Benioff seems to have stayed at home. Travis Kalanick of Uber stayed at home. Brian Chesky of
Airbnb did not go. Jack Dorsey was not invited because it turned out, and I didn't believe this, I thought this is fake news for sure, until it was confirmed by the Trump campaign, that Twitter had refused to make a custom emoticon for Crooked Hillary. And that apparently that failed emoji deal was enough to keep Jack Dorsey from getting an invite. Not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. So I guess the question, and Kara Swisher's going to be on in a couple of weeks because I'm going to ask her. She said you should absolutely not go. She interviewed Chris Sacca, who said it was in effect endorsing fascism. I disagree. I think it was probably a good thing to go. But it didn't mean you had to smile. There's Tim Cook not smiling.
I don't think anyone smiled.
I think they said Jeff Bezos was kind of voluble, but isn't that... So was this a bad idea to go, or was it a good idea to go?
I'll tell you what. I was there. Not in the room, but I was...
You were out in the tower, standing there on Fifth Avenue?
I was in the lobby with the press scrum, waiting for a chance to maybe have one of the executives come by and talk to us. I got the impression they did not want to be there. Many of them kind of swooped through the lobby and didn't even, like, I missed them. Like, I never saw Tim Cook. Like, he was, I don't know, he had some kind of stealthy ninja skills or something, and he got on that elevator before anyone could catch him. Same with Bezos and same with Musk. And Satya Nadella just whisked through.
See, I said at the time, this happened, that the thing to look at is what they say and how they act afterwards. That's when you'll know if they got spanked, if they got some, you know, got to say something. It's interesting. They snuck out of there pretty much.
Nadella literally ran when the meeting was over.
He ran. Maybe he was late for a plane.
It was really funny. I mean, he has a private jet, but they didn't want to be there. It was clear they didn't want to talk to the press about it. You know, a lot of times when people meet with Trump, they'll come and talk to the scrum and say it was a great meeting and some, you know, platitudes about that. And there was none of that. They were in and out, all of them. And a lot of them came in through a different entrance so they could sneak on the elevators easier. It was an interesting day standing in Trump Tower for 6 hours.
For no apparent purpose. Most of them were Clinton supporters during the campaign. But I think I would guess that their chief interest was not giving making this a media opportunity for Trump.
Yeah, well, they did that whole thing. They had cameras in the room and stuff.
Right. Go ahead.
Well, they had cameras in the room for the first couple minutes. I think, yeah, go. But the protest I would like to see them lodge is the protest against saying that the meeting was going to be off the record, which, of course, it wasn't. Kara got them to talk, and I think other people will hear really what happened there, which wasn't so remarkable, judging from the rumors coming out of there. I think the protest would have been saying, yeah, I'm going to go, but I'm not going to hide this from the public. We're not going to be collaborating in secret to do something behind the public's back. We're going to talk about what happened in there. This is the people's business. And if you're going to be talking about what the direction of the Trump administration is in the most important industry in this country, maybe the people need to know about this. So to me, the two big things coming out of it were, they weren't talking whatever it was, and that Trump's kids were in the room. That four seats
went to the family. Seats.
Yeah, I mean, which to me is actually, we've seen this before, but it's kind of a shocking circumstance to me that when you have a meeting like this, you have these four people, and so maybe Jared Kushner. He's sort of a consigliere unofficially there, but to have your other kids in the room, there's no security clearance, there's no official point in the transition for them. It's just basically what you see in countries that aren't democracies with stuff like this. So I think that's disappointing, and I can't imagine that the big brains in the room were impressed by that.
It's not unprecedented for a president to use his family in some degree. I mean, Hillary Clinton worked on health reform for Bill Clinton.
She wasn't sitting in the meeting.
She wasn't.
And to be honest, she, you know, if she were in one of the meetings, it could be more easily justified. You know, she was a distinguished person in her own right who, you know, achieved quite a lot without having, you know, been inheriting, you know, the business she was involved in.
Here are some of the quotes.
It also shows such a huge conflict of interest as they're still running his businesses.
Right.
And then they're also sitting in on meetings that could influence the way that people are going to be doing business with them.
As Ivanka Trump sat in with the Prime Minister of Japan earlier. These are some quotes from Kara's sources. One source, she says, said the meeting was weird but not as awkward as it could have been. Another said Trump was reasonable and fair the whole time. You know, clearly one of the reasons is there are several reasons why the CEOs go. One is, of course, the president-elect asks you, you go. But there's also the carrot of repatriating. I mean, I would love to see the math for how many billions of dollars are offshore dollars are represented by these CEOs. Apple alone is many. What is it? 18 billion? More than that. And Trump has promised repatriation of that money for a lowered tax rate. That's one of the things they'd like. Satya Nadella asked for a better H-1B visa situation. That's something Trump's been kind of inconsistent on. On the one hand, acknowledging that they're often misused, bringing in less skilled tech employees to replace American tech workers. But of course, Silicon Valley argues, but no, we need to bring in the smart ones. The H-1B visas are for the most educated workers that we can't get here in the United States. Elon Musk apparently brought up climate change, or at least did in another meeting. There was some head shaking about Larry Page. Kara writes, here's an outlier I personally liked. Alphabet CEO Page brought up about infrastructure spending, the need to rejigger the electrical grid, something about AC current versus DC current. But everyone I spoke to was a little confused by this. That's kind of what you'd expect Larry Page to come in and say, you know, we should really convert this all to DC. No one would say to Kara, none of her sources would say who brought up the repatriation issue, but it was brought up. I don't see a problem with it, and I understand why they skipped out quickly so as to not make it a big photo op. But I think it was reasonable that they go and try to build a bridge, right?
No, yeah, make sure, sense that they sure. go. Yeah. You go.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't really but have I think one choice. This is the administration that they're going to be having to.
Well, they could say no. I mean, Kalanick said no, apparently. Chesky said no. Mark Benioff said no.
Kalanick's on his team, though.
Oh, really?
Yeah, then we hear Kalanick is going to be on the team, as Steve said,
Working
with the transition. Yeah.
Travis Kalanick, the CEO of Uber. Well, Uber's interesting because Uber's been in a constant battle with local governments at first to get, you know, to get in the cities because taxi commissions and taxi medallion owners didn't want Uber in there. Now they're fighting with the state of California and the city of San Francisco because the city of San Francisco says they never paid the cheap, by the way, $150 autonomous vehicle license for those autonomous Volvos that Uber started to drive around on Wednesday in San Francisco. Uber says, well, you don't make people who drive Teslas with autopilot pay it, so we're not gonna.
This is an interesting.
Go ahead.
This is an interesting pattern. We did a story a couple weeks ago. We broke a story where Otto, which is the self-driving truck company,
also owned by Uber.
Yeah, right before they went to Uber, and maybe this helped make them attractive to Uber, is they did a big test run in Nevada. And as it turns out, they didn't have the proper license, you know, or authorization to do that. And there was actually, our reporter found some really heated correspondence going on beforehand where the Nevada DMV said, you can't do this without the authorization. And they just did it anyway. And the irony was that the regulation was actually pretty much written by one of the co-founders of Otto when he was at Google. You know, Google's lobbyist got in there and essentially wrote the regulation. And they violated it anyway. And I guess because they wrote the regulation, they knew that there was no penalty for violating the regulation. So now this particular fellow is the head now of the Uber self-driving car unit. And apparently he likes, going on and asking forgiveness rather than permission, or saying, I don't care whether you forgive me or not.
And by the way, Uber bought him right after for $680 million. I could see why Travis Kalanick might want to get into the corridors of power and bypass this whole regulation thing.
And Trump is good for them. Trump is anti-regulation.
Right.
So, it very well could be. I think we did another story saying that the Trump administration might be the best thing that ever happened to Uber in terms of this regulation.
Well, that's what's really interesting about all this, because even though these CEOs all were, for the most part, Clinton supporters, they stand to make some major gains. It's hard to know what a Trump administration would look like, but I think one thing it's pretty apparent from his cabinet picks is he's probably good for big business, and that's what these guys run is big businesses. So maybe there isn't this natural antipathy. Maybe there's just some of this partisan antipathy, but it does seem like these guys could probably, get a lot more even than repatriation from a Trump administration.
Right, but then you see silly things like him promising they're going to start building iPhones here in the United States, and it's just untenable stuff like that.
He hasn't said anything about that since the part of the problem is there's this big red line, but pre-election, post-election. And already they've repudiated many of the things they said pre-election. And I haven't heard anything about bringing iPhone production back to the United States. I think what would happen pretty quickly is you'd find out that it's just not practical. And it wouldn't bring jobs, because all you're doing is bringing the robots back.
Right. And, they probably, when it comes to jobs, which I think was like the main topic of this whole thing, the repatriation plays into that, right? They kind of dangle, okay, we'll give you a better tax rate when you want to repatriate that cash. But in exchange, we need to see some more jobs created here. Now, again, those aren't the kind of jobs that, Trump has been promising. They're not blue collar jobs. They're not manufacturing jobs. They're high skilled, highly educated jobs. So there's just that irony there, too.
Here's some more confusion. Here's an article from November 20th, 2015. Donald Trump's plan for a Muslim database in a Newton, Iowa campaign stop. He said, I would certainly implement that. Absolutely. There should be lots of systems beyond databases. We should have a lot of systems. Then the Trump team a year later saying he never advocated for a Muslim database. And now Silicon Valley tech workers planning to not build the database that Donald Trump either does or doesn't want. We live in interesting times, do we not?
Yeah. I mean, this whole Muslim database thing was a strange story this week, because, these tech companies are getting cheered for vowing not to do it.
When no one's asked them to.
No one's asked them to, and they didn't start falling in line until, I forget what I think it was Twitter, or maybe only one company, major company, came out and said, like, flat out, no, we're not doing this when asked, I believe.
Well,
I
remember, Gina Rometty of IBM wrote
Gina
Rometty of IBM wrote a open letter to President-elect Trump a couple of weeks ago, pledging her support, the support of IBM. And, of course, people immediately pointed out the IBM had made a database for the Nazis. And so there was some clamor over that. And then who was it? Was it Safra Catz? Was it Oracle that promised to do anything that the Trump administration wanted? So I think some of this is in response to that. Neveragain.tech. We, the undersigned employees of tech organizations and companies, engineers, business executives, designers, we commit to refuse to participate in the creation of databases. 600 people have signed. It's quite a few, including, most of the big companies at that table. But it's almost, good. I mean, right on. Don't. No, you shouldn't do that. Clearly, that's a bad idea. And it's a pledge anybody can get behind. It feels like right now there's a lot of confusion and wheel spinning. And I wonder what these tech executives sitting at this table really think? Really, what they don't? Wouldn't it be reasonable, as in most cases, CEOs of publicly held, publicly traded companies, that they look to find any advantage that they can for their business? And if you're talking to the future president of the United States, that's where you go to lobby for the stuff that's good for your business.
I can't. No, you're absolutely right on that. But there's two tracks here. There's the pure bottom line track, and then there's the morals track, the vision track. Most of these Silicon Valley CEOs believe that their companies aren't just money machines, but they're doing things that are good for the world. And in two major areas, the Trump administration is clearly diverging from core values of these companies in the good for the world category. One is diversity, which a lot of these companies, even though their employment roles may not reflect it, they certainly like to talk about how they're going to do better in achieving diversity among their ranks. And the second is climate change. And, you know, companies like Google and Facebook, even though they're software companies, you know, they work very hard to prove their data centers are green. And climate change is something they really believe in. Apple has a head of environment who used to be head of the EPA. I doubt she's going to quit and join the Trump administration. So I think there's this tension there. Whereas, you know, on one hand, it might be good for their bottom line. They didn't vote for the guy and they don't like this guy.
Yeah. I have to point out that at least in diversity, it's more about public relations than actually really doing anything. I do think that companies are doing a lot about climate change. Google announced this year that they're going to be 100% solar powered by 2017 for everything. Their network centers, their business operations, their office operations, 100% solar. So I think that they're serious about that. But somewhat it seems to be about optics more than anything else. You know, if Twitter's worried about it, we better put out an open letter. All right, enough. We don't want to do too much politics. It's just that's a big tech story. We're all there, and I don't know what to say about it. I thought it was interesting. Elon Musk has now added tunnel drilling on Twitter as one of the things he's interested in. After tweeting that he hated traffic so much, he wanted to drill a tunnel to drive to work. He's taking
an underground hyperloop.
What's interesting is, wouldn't the tunnel become immediately exactly as congested as anything else? His Elon Musk's new bio says Tesla SpaceX tunnels. Yes, tunnels. And he wants to call it the boring company. Traffic is driving me nuts. I'm going to build a tunnel boring machine and just start digging. I'm actually, his most recent tweet, I'm actually going to do this.
Oh my God.
I thought at first this was the fake Elon Musk. This is the real Elon Musk.
That could be the new status symbol, your own private tunnel.
Tunnel. I have a tunnel to work. Forget helicopters. I'm going underground. All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, AirPods are for sale. Apple finally released them. Where were they? What was happening? And, are any of you getting them? Mine's not coming till next year.
I have them right here.
I didn't order them fast enough. Now, are those the pre-production or the actual?
These are the actual ones. They sent me a review of the real ones, too. Right.
Well, I'll ask you about that in a moment. Amazon Echo's going into 4,700 Wynn Las Vegas rooms starting in the summer. And Congress moves to ban ticket scalping, all coming up. Our show today brought to you by stamps.com. This is basically like tunnel boring for the post office. Why even go to the post office when you can do everything you do at the post office right at your own desk with your computer and your printer at stamps.com? Stamps.com lets you buy and print real U.S. postage. It lets you label. You can print right on envelopes, label boxes. It'll help you choose the right form of mail, give you the price list for all of them. You get a USB scale, which makes it very easy for you to make sure you have exactly the right postage, neither too little or too much. It just makes you look more professional. I want you to try stamps.com, and we've got a really good trial for you. If you go to stamps.com, click the microphone in the upper right-hand corner and use the offer code TWIT at stamps.com. You don't have to go to the post office. Holiday season is the worst time of the year to go to the post office. Amateur hour. Now you can do it all right from the comfort of your own desk. You'll get a trial of stamps.com, but you also get $55 in postage coupons you can use over the first few months of your account. You get that $5 supplies kit and a free digital scale you plug into the USB port. This is so awesome that will automatically weigh and give you the exact right amount of postage. In fact, you'll see on the screen, this is how much it weighs, and these are the different ways you can mail it. It'll even recommend media mail if it's appropriate. It is awesome, and I know you're going to love it, and it's going to make you look more professional. Whether you sell on eBay, Amazon, Etsy, you send out flyers or bills, stamps.com. By the way, if you do use, you know, if you are an eBay or Etsy or an Amazon seller, you'll love this because it takes the information for your buyer from the website, fills it in, fills in customs forms, any express mail forms, anything that you need to fill in, it fills in automatically. Try it free right now and get this special $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale at stamps.com. Click the microphone and type in TWIT. Stamps.com. We thank them for their support of This Week in Tech. Stephen Kovac is here. From Business Insider, he's senior correspondent. Hey, Steve.
Very fancy title.
Very fancy. Stephen Levy, one of the original, the best computer journalists. What is it? Is it the 30th anniversary now of Hackers?
It's 32.
It was 32. Published in 1984. Holy cow. And written so many great books since then.
John Markoff recently retired from the New York Times.
I was just going to ask you about that. Yeah. So now you're the longest standing senior.
Well, there's a few others. Larry Magid. There's a few others from that era who are around. But I know that I kind of dated. You know, there was at one point Microsoft did this thing of the Hood Canal, which is Bill Gates's little vacation complex and his family, and they pulled together some of the reporters of that era to go and have a pajama party with Steve Ballmer and Bill. And
wait a minute. A pajama party?
That's what that we jokingly called it. We went, on seaplanes to the Hood Canal, which is looks like a lake to me, but apparently they call it the Hood Canal. It's a saltwater body east of Seattle. And, we spent 2 days, we did this for 2 years in a row, talking to Steve and Bill. They gave us a download on the company and really went deep and then we'd peel off. Bill's family usually vacations there. So, a guy slept in one of Bill's sister's rooms.
Wow.
So Markoff and I were the last working reporters left from that trip. And now he's going to still be working. He's going to be a historian for the Computer History Museum.
I saw that. I think that's great. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But no longer a Timesman.
You never worked in a newspaper, or did you, Stephen?
No, not full time.
Long form, feature length kind of stuff in books.
Well, I started writing for weekly publications and then
Newsweek.
Then the later Newsweek and then magazines mostly.
Yeah. Wired. And you're back at Condé Nast, which is funny because you started
Rolling Stone, yeah.
You wrote Rolling Stone too, yeah.
I started writing about technology for Rolling Stone. That was my first tech stories.
No kidding.
Yeah, the Hackers started with an article about computer hackers at Stanford that I wrote in 1982.
Wow. I salute you, sir. And of course, all the old guys have been on this show. I don't know what that is, but and I love John, and he's great, and I'm glad he's found something he wants to do. I think that the Computer History Museum will be a good place for him. Although I hope he continues to write. I'd love to see him writing more long form stuff. That would be kind of cool. Let's see, what other stories do we have here? Pebble, you wrote a good. A story, Stephen, on the end of Pebble and what happened there. What happened?
Which Stephen are you talking to? We both wrote it.
You both wrote that story, huh?
Steve also did a story, yeah.
So between the two of you, what happened?
I'll let him go first.
Okay.
They didn't sell enough watches. It's basically, they were not profitable.
Yeah.
And when you're not making money, bad things happen. And you know, can you outspend the money you have? They started out. It's a fascinating story. I met them when they were at Y Combinator in 2011, and they were the only hardware startup, I think, in the bunch. And they were probably the lowest funded company in that whole bunch. And then they came out of it. And since they didn't have much funding, they decided to do a Kickstarter for their first product, the first watch.
Brilliant.
And it did great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for a couple of years, they were going well. And then the last year, they had a bad second half, didn't make the numbers, and never were profitable again. And early this year, they laid people off. Steve was able to nail down something that I didn't get on the record, which was, they almost got bought by a company. But this year, they tried to make it, and they could not. They had a couple of interesting new products that they did a Kickstarter on because they couldn't get funding to do it the normal way. And as the year went on, it became clear that there was no exit. They went to some wacky ideas. They explored weird private equity companies and even an idea that they would cut down to like 10 people and see if they can keep going. But the only exit turned out to be a sale, and it turned out to be Fitbit.
Yeah, Steve, so tell me about that, because I think people were surprised to see that they had at one point an offer of, what was it, $74 million?
Well, that wasn't true. So
that was not true. Okay.
That was not true. That was I spent a week trying to dig into that, and it seemed really funny that someone told TechCrunch that there was a $740 million offer on the table from Citizen, the Japanese watchmaker. That just didn't make sense. You look at Citizen's market cap, it's not that much. That's almost half of Citizen's market cap.
Yeah.
So why would they spend that on? So I heard that was someone disgruntled, like literally lying to the press.
Well, why'd they stop at 74? Although that's kind of.
No, 740 million.
740.
So I mean, that's just insane. It sounded like, oh man, how could they turn down that acquisition? That would have been such a nice exit for them. They would have had this cushion of, a traditional watchmaker, which we've seen, like Fossil buy, smart watchmaker.
It almost makes sense because the traditional watchmakers, don't they want to find new markets? And I mean, watch sales have to be down overall.
Right. But it turns out that's not what happened. So, the Citizen thing was there was actually a collaboration between the two companies. Pebble paid Citizen about $50,000 to help them design the Round, which is that circular watch that launched, like a year ago or so. It turned out they ended up not using Citizen's design. Citizen submitted like 10 designs. Pebble found them a little too thick and chunky. They were really looking for something slimmer. And they went internally with their own design. And literally that, was the end of the relationship with Citizen. There was no offer. There was no acquisition talks. Maybe internally Citizen discussed it or something, but there's certainly no nothing formal, and there definitely wasn't anything for $740 million.
Thank you for doing the legwork and debunking that, because I think it made it really made the rounds. Everybody kind of I repeated that number.
Yeah, and then it became this thing like, what a fool, and it made Eric Majakovsky, the CEO, look like an idiot which he's not. So the real acquisition that fell through was the Intel one in late spring-ish of this year. That was for approximately $70 million. There's a little debate internally at the company why that fell through. Intel ultimately withdrew, and the offer was higher than $70 million. Then they went down to $70 million. So it's unclear who exactly said no. Some people think Eric was trying to get more than 70. Some people say no. It's kind of a he said, she said situation. But once that deal fell through, everyone at the company knew things were on the way out. And the employees were even offered a chance saying, hey, we know things look bad. you guys can leave now. We'll give you a severance package. Or if you guys want to stay on and try to see this thing through to the end, we'll double your shares in the company. And some people left, but a lot of people did stay on and hoping those new products like the Core and the Time 2 would kind of reinvigorate interest in the company. But ultimately, that just didn't happen.
The Core was kind of interesting. The idea was you have Amazon Echo kind of built into a little worry bead in your pocket.
Yeah, I wish that thing actually came out.
A lot of people wish that they're going to refund your money.
Yeah.
But what's I think one of the reasons is an interesting story, and people assumed that Pebble was doing better than they were, is that they did such a good job of raising money on Kickstarter with three separate campaigns, raising many millions of dollars. They were the first kind of breakout Kickstarter campaign.
But when you look at that money, even if it's like $12 million was the latest one,
right,
really to be successful, they have to sell through their channels, Best Buy and other places, like that. So you really get your, table money, table stakes from, starting on there and getting some money in advance. The real money comes when you really build out the channels to many millions of people. I think they had 24,000 buyers for the Pebble Core, and that's a product that if it's successful, would have had 1 million buyers.
Yeah. I think maybe in some ways that's the problem with being a success on Kickstarter. It seems like a lot, and it's really not. It's
a pre-order.
It's a pre-order.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that from an emotional standpoint, people are sad to see Pebble go. It was one of the first smartwatches that were hitting the ground running. And I think that everyone that I know all of my tech friends have a Pebble. And so it's really sad. But in the end, it's survival of the fittest. And, they just couldn't keep their momentum going with it.
Well, and here's the real question. People combine this with the announcement by Motorola. They're not going to work on any more 360 Android Wear watches for at least for the time being. And looked at sales of the Apple Watch, whether you believe IDC or you believe Tim Cook, they maybe don't look like a significant amount. And Fitbit is the only one that seems to be doing well in the market. And it's mostly selling low-end, inexpensive, pedometer-style fitness devices.
Right. And its stock is way down. I mean,
and it's
basically
not doing that well. Is this category dead?
When I talked to Eric, and he was nice enough to sit down with me, because mainly I really like the company. I've been following them pretty closely over the last couple of years. We even had a series that we called Adventures of Pebble, where every couple times a year I would check in when they had something new, and we'd write about it early. And he told me that his big mistake, he thought, was not seeing early on that it really was all about fitness for these things. That was the number one thing that people wanted to do with these, wrist wearables. You wouldn't even call it a watch. And the last group of products had increased fitness features. They had a heartbeat monitor. They all had GPS that worked offline. So he was hoping that would align them for what people are using it. But in general, the transition from watch to smartwatch has not been gangbusters. And Apple's professes to be happy with what they're doing, but if you look at what they've done, they've doubled down on fitness,
right,
and they don't talk about it as a fashion item anymore.
Right. They eliminated the gold, if very expensive gold one.
Your gold watch now is now obsolete, which you could probably know if you gave it about 10 minutes thought before you sprung $24,000 for it.
Well, I guess anybody with that kind of money to spend probably didn't care.
They weren't really caring whether their watch was going to be obsolete enough. If you can shell out that much money for a smartwatch of the first gen, then you can probably afford to get another one when they want. I think that the problem when people talk about our wearables dead because of the prices, the thing with it is you cannot compare them the same to a laptop or a phone. Odds are if you're going to get a smartwatch, you're going to buy one. And that's going to be good for many years. You're not going to be upgrading it every single year. So if they did sell over 12 million year one, that's a lot of wearable smartwatches that Apple has sold. And then you're not going to upgrade it. So this is something that you have, and it's good, and you're still using it. So most of the people that were really interested and wanted to get on board right away have already bought one, and they're probably not going to be upgrading for 3 or 4 years. And so only then will we be able to see. I think that when watches become more autonomous and you're able to use them without your phone, that's when we're going to see a huge spring in wearables, because Fitbit is always going to take the low-end market for something that's going to be cheap, easy, and just deal with fitness, whereas Apple is going to take that high-end market where you're going to be able to replace it eventually for your phone.
Steve, you wrote a couple of weeks ago, wearables are dead.
Yeah, I totally disagree with that. I mean, they were pitching this thing and all smartwatches as a new kind of computing platform. I mean, from the very beginning, the Apple Watch was pitched as, you know, it decreases your reliance on the phone, and you know, you're going to be able to do just about everything on your wrist versus, you know, on your phone. But that just doesn't make sense. I mean, you look at, you know, so many of the original applications for this Apple Watch were just like shrunken down versions of what you see on your smartphone. Like, no one wants to squint at
unusable
little Instagram photos.
Unusable, shrunken down versions.
Yeah, slowness aside, let's pretend it was super fast, okay?
Yeah.
You don't want to squint at Instagrams or tweets or headlines from New York Times on your wrist.
Plus,
it
the
just
inscrutable
doesn't make sense.
UI. I mean,
yeah. And they fixed that. A lot of that's been fixed now. The UI issues. I mean, it's better, but it's better as a passive device, as a fitness tracker, heart rate monitor. You know, maybe notifications and of course time, but then again, do you really need to spend between $300 and $500 for that? No.
It's not just, by the way, it's not just fitness, because it's really casual fitness. Because if you're a runner, a serious fitness buff, you're going to get a serious runner's watch, and it's not going to be one of these. It's going to be from Garmin or Polar. It's going to be a much more serious device. And I don't think these middle ground devices really aid into that market particularly. So it's for casual fitness users. That's a fairly small market.
Well, Apple wants to get into that. I mean, they really took a lot of care to make sure you could swim with a watch, which is not the first thing I want to do when I buy a watch, but you know, they have this amazing thing, and it's like shows how when Apple wants to be fanatical about something, it does it. Is, you know, one of the big features of the watch is that you can swim in it, and then, you know, when you turn that part on, you know, and turn it off.
It spits
the water out. Yeah, which is kind of amazing, right? I mean,
amazing, slightly ineffective, but amazing.
It's amazing, but it's not $350. Amazing.
No, but I think that what we're missing is that it's not just for health, but I think that one of the biggest features for the Apple Watch that's often overlooked is for safety. I think that the SOS safe feature, especially if you're dealing with someone that you don't know if they might fall down or get hurt and be able to, is absolutely amazing. You're saving $40 a month just in that. So it saves you actual money if you were going to plan on buying your parent something that's going to be able to track them, and they're going to be able to call out for safety for that. And so the SOS feature in itself is going to save you money within year one. And so that's why I think that it's going to be one of these devices that, yeah, it's new, it's out, they're getting their grounding. Definitely, Steve, I think that you're absolutely right. I think that there's a certain amount of expectational debt. For people that thought that this would replace your phone, no. I think that anyone that would have thought that, though, wasn't really thinking about the small interface and the way that they could use it. And they're going to be able to have to get their feet gripped to be able to see what exactly, how do we use our watch and what will be useful versus not. I think that the scribble feature has made messaging so much easier, and the dictation is much better than it was before. But it's, again, this is a first gen product, so you can only expect so much to it now, second gen.
It's interesting that Apple's strategy here has been to find 100 different little things like that emergency button, like swimming,
the breathe app,
which are all niches, and it almost feels like they're trying to cobble together enough niche products to make one whole product. And I think the fundamental problem with the Pebble, with the Apple Watch, with Android Wear watches is, face it, you don't really need it. And I wonder if we're entering, it's not that we're, maybe, are we in economic hard times? I never know. It seems like we are, we aren't, I don't know. The job numbers are good, but Donald Trump says everything's crap. So somewhere there's some, I don't know what's going on. But I feel like when you are in hard times, or if at least people psychologically are reluctant to spend discretionary money, that a watch is the easy thing to say, well, I'm not going to buy that. That's the one where you can just say, yeah, I don't think I'll spend money on that. Apple's managed to stay alive in this market, but it feels like they're hanging on by their fingernails. And when you see Pebble and Motorola and ultimately even Fitbit struggling.
And Google.
And Google, I mean, they make
where it's just like, what's going on there? It's they delayed it, and their partners are just kind of abandoning the platform.
Nobody needs
it. Oh.
And of course, if anybody's going to sell something nobody needs, Apple's probably the best person to do it because they're just brilliant marketers. They're brilliant at creating an aura and a mystique around it. But that's not going to be enough in the long run to save the category. So you know what? I'm going to have to rule in your favor, Steve Kovac. I guess
we'll see in 2 years.
I said
back for 2 years now to find out, is the Apple Watch still alive?
I own an edition.
My vote is it will be.
I own an edition. You know, it's interesting. I was in Vegas. Yeah, there you go. Georgia is. I was in Vegas, and a lot of people in Vegas, a lot of Chinese people in Vegas were wearing Apple Watches. So I think this is where Apple's so good at. Apple's become, I think, a fashion brand. And so when you're selling a fashion product, status and look, and that it becomes more important than functionality. So in the rest of the world where when it comes to spending an extra $350, you can easily forego buying the fitness watch or the smartwatch. That business is going to die. That business is going to tank. And unfortunately, Apple doesn't release numbers. So we don't, you know, Apple could say it's the best. We had as Tim Cook did, the best weekend we've ever had for the Apple Watch is meaningless. That means what? They sold a few? I don't know what that means. But
see, I don't know if it's so much of a fashion brand because I don't know. I don't really find the watch that beautiful.
Well, that's the problem. It's an ugly fashion.
I do think that it's a status. I think that it's a status symbol, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. I notice when other people are watching and wearing an Apple Watch. It also shows their level of technology that they enjoy, which, you know, I like. But I don't know. I think that for fashion in and of itself, I think that the watch kind of ends up a little bit short.
Ben Thompson on Stratechery had a good article last month on niche strategies.
That was awesome.
Yeah,
talking about
things like the Surface Studio, which I'm using right now, the Nintendo Switch. He even says the PC market in general is in some respects a niche product. He says for most people, particularly outside the U.S., a smartphone is all they need or care to buy. The world today is the exact opposite of the world a mere decade ago where we bought dedicated devices to plug into our digital hub PCs. The smartphone and cloud is now the hub. Everything else is optional. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing. It's too bad, though. I think Pebble was a nice story. What's going to happen? Fitbit's going to acquire them. Will they keep many of the employees? Are they going to go? What's going to happen to what's left of Pebble?
It sounds like
less than half.
Half. Mm-hmm.
The software people. Side.
So that they can put it into a Fitbit.
Yeah, the question is, I guess, how much of the Pebble iOS morphs into what will be the Fitbit iOS. Eric indicated to me that the one thing he tried to do in that deal was to give some sort of bridge for developers. So the work that they have done on Pebble might still live on in some way and they'd be able to write in the future to the platform that takes over some of the ideas, if not the code, of the Pebble iOS.
Minchikovsky seems like a good guy.
He's super nice.
What happens to him now?
Y Combinator.
Oh, yeah, you said that, right.
Yeah.
So he's going to mentor.
I think so.
That's the end of the line for the entrepreneur, right? All right, I'm done starting companies. I'll go be an angel investor and a mentor.
He's a young guy.
I think he's 30 years old. Yeah, and what a story.
It's an amazing
21,
story.
He started the company. So this is the first time in his adult life that he's not running a company. I think my guess is eventually he will be running another company.
He's going to look for his next thing.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I hope so. Let's take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about Magic Leap and what's going on there. I'm curious what you all think, because I'm not sure what to think. I mean, on the one hand, it looks like it might be the next Theranos. On the other hand, maybe it's just a hard thing to solve. I bet Stephen Levy has some thoughts on that. First, though, a word from Squarespace. That's where I make my website, my home on the web. And I think a lot of you are already, but if you're not, if you're looking for somewhere Let me tell you, Squarespace is the simplest, the best way to create a beautiful website, whether you're a designer, and of course, if you're a designer, aesthetics are paramount. A photographer, you got to have aesthetics and functionality, right? A filmmaker, a writer, a musician, a freelancer, a blogger. If you sell online, for all of you, Squarespace is the place to make your next website. It's the best hosting tied with the best software. It's a great content management system. You start with the Squarespace templates, beautifully designed and beautifully engineered. You see the design, but under the hood, incredible engineering that gives every Squarespace site the modern features that you need on your website. Things like mobile responsive design. So one site fits any size screen. In this day and age, that's what you need. You don't need a separate mobile site. You need a site that looks good no matter what size screen your visitors are using. And every site has e-commerce built in. And I venture to say it's the only web hosting, web software that gives you e-commerce that looks every bit as good as your site, because it is. It's the same design, the same template. It's not some afterthought hanging off your site. It is your site. And all of the features, they have an amazing commerce platform. You'll definitely want to check that out. Squarespace is also very fast, reliable hosting with an amazing uptime record. You cannot bring a Squarespace site down. You get a free custom domain name with an annual purchase. By the way, they do now sell domain names with over 200 top-level domains, so you can get your domain name right from Squarespace. One of the advantages of that is you'll get a, if you're not ready to design the site yet, when you buy the domain at Squarespace, you get a beautiful parking page with Squarespace's style and template. So it doesn't look like one of those janky parking pages those other guys offer you. It really looks nice. Squarespace members who have built or contributed 3 or more active websites, and that's, by the way, that's a lot of them, because once you do it once, you want to do it again and again. There's even a lot of people who have made a living designing and selling Squarespace sites. You'll get access to Squarespace Circle. Circle membership includes advanced guides, optimized support, 6-month trial periods for new projects, and more. But all of you can try it for free regardless. Just go to squarespace.com, click the Get Started button, and play with it. You'll see how it's great. They've got a new magazine-style templates with grid-style landing pages, infinite scroll-related posts, the author profile, the integrated search field. I'm a big fan. It's where I host my site. It's where we host our Inside Twit site. You're going to like it, squarespace.com. If you, after you try it, you decide to buy, use the offer code TWIT, and you'll get 10% off. Squarespace.com. Don't forget that offer code TWIT. If you decide to buy. We're talking the week's tech news. Georgia Dow is here from iMore.com. The lone Apple Watch defender. I've got my watch edition. I love it. It's beautiful. I wore it. I wear it a lot, but it is a little thick and clunky and big. And
it
I don't,
is a little bit thick.
The thing about it, it has that trait where if you leave it behind, you don't go, I got to go back and get it. You can live without it.
I feel differently after wear, like, you know, this, like, so since I use the 7 Plus, it's huge. And so I can leave my phone in my purse. I don't have to worry about missing anything. Because I'm a psychotherapist, I'm in session the entire time. If someone has an emergency, they're able to reach me in between session. And
so that's another one of those niches. Like nurses, psychotherapists, doctors, they like the notification feature.
Definitely. Definitely at the beginning, because it's just not a device that can work on its own as of yet. But that's the beginning of it, right? Yeah. And eventually that's what it's going to end up being, is a device that you can use on the run when you want to be able to travel light. It's never going to be able to replace a laptop or your phone. And if you're expecting that, I think that you'll be very sorely upset. But it will be something that eventually you're going to be able to use and go out when you're running or, you know, dealing with something or exercising or what. And you don't have to carry your phone with you, because everyone hates having to carry their phone in their pocket or in their purse. They're heavy, they're large, they're clunky. You end up with that bonus of the real estate, but then you end up with that weight and carrying in that extra luggage that you may not want. And in the end, all of our smart devices are going to be something that's small and easy and wearable. It's just we haven't gotten the math right yet. And of course, that's going to take
That's why we needed the Pebble Core.
I know.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I hear you.
I know.
I hear you. I hear that sadness for it. It's just... It's one. Yeah. I feel sad too about losing Pebble, just because I think that we need to have that, you know, a whole bunch of people in the ecosphere so that they're going to be able to, you know, that competition and new ideas and be able to do things. So, you know, it's sad when we lose a great company that made all kinds of different innovations.
Stephen Levy of Back Channel, you did Eric Majakowski's kind of exit interview, right? You talked to him after.
Yeah.
So is he? How is he feeling? He should feel proud, right? Yeah.
I think he does feel proud. I think he was balancing a lot of emotions. The day I talked to him was the day that deal closed. And you know, he was nice enough to spend time with me and talk about it. I think he was upset for his employees more than himself. He'll have a soft landing. Though he's not walking away like a rich person. There have been a lot of exits in Silicon Valley where companies didn't do well and the executives walked away, you know, super rich, right?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
They managed to take money off and buy Ferraris or whatever.
So he never took money off the table on any of that?
I can't speak to what he did or didn't take off, but I know that
he ain't driving a Ferrari.
He's not driving a Ferrari. He's not living in a palace. If I were starting a hardware company and I could hire him, I certainly would. This is a guy who knows how to go to China and, you know, get a product together.
Right. That is increasingly useful skill, I have to say. I was talking about websites. And I was thinking about Joshua Topolsky, who's doing kind of something, a little swimming upstream. He's just launched his new site, theoutline.com. And kind of, content aside, and I'm not really sure where he's going with the content, but it's an interesting design, really targeting mobile, I think, with a lot of scrolling sideways and up and down scrolling and animated graphics. And have you guys played with it? Well, I was curious what you thought of it.
I'm not crazy about it. It's tough to read, even on mobile. Like it's very jarring and like neon, and it just seems unnecessary. I mean, we saw this, you know, when they're experimenting in the early days of The Verge, trying to, you know, stuff like a lot of like layout and responsive designs and so forth onto the web, and it just doesn't always make sense on the web. I just want to be able to read it.
Well,
clearly.
I wonder, and maybe Stephen Levy, you could talk to this about the idea of creating a site these days. I mean, it seems to me nobody goes to a site anymore to read stuff. They get to an article from Facebook or Twitter or friends or whatever via links. And my initial thought was that one of the things Josh was trying to do here is make it sticky. That once you get to the site, you kind of, because of the interesting design, are kind of encouraged to browse around a little bit. What's your experience with Backchannel? Do people enter at the front door?
Increasingly, when we started, they didn't do it. And when we started, actually, you couldn't even go to backchannel.com. It was medium.com/backchannel. Eventually, we did manage to Medium changed its policy and did domains when they decided to emphasize publications more. And then we did manage to get backchannel.com. So we're starting to see some. But one reason why I went to start it on Medium is that I felt it was going to be super tough just to start something on its own without some sort of traffic funnel. And that dovetailed with Ev Williams' theory that there's going to be just a very few platforms, whether it's Twitter or Facebook and something else, and people aren't going to hopscotch from one place to another, that you're going to get your attention from platforms. And the Medium would be one of those platforms. So right now we've got about 150,000 followers just on Medium, right? So that's the slice of the world which is signed in the Medium. 150,000 of those people are signed in. And then when they open their Medium app, they could see, oh, there's a story on Backchannel you haven't read. And they get a daily email saying, you know, here's what you missed in Backchannel. So we can get a really good chunk of our traffic, a baseline from that, in addition to people coming through recommendations in Facebook or Twitter or Hacker News or whatever.
I just find this interesting. I guess it's a little bit inside baseball, but I notice my own habits changing a lot. And it's really changed because of two things, Facebook and Twitter. That's the site most people – I mean, I have medium.com and backchannel.com bookmarked, but I'm much more likely to go to Facebook and follow links into those sites.
It's not the bookmark. Don't you follow us on Medium? Didn't you get a little email saying, you know, yesterday
well,
Medium?
And okay, so this is...
Does
this,
anyone do that anymore?
Yeah, everybody does. This
that's
is the new thing. It's the new hotness.
I don't think... I'm almost... Whenever someone says, my site wants to send you a notification, I want to be able to turn that off.
Turn that off.
always.
Jason Calacanis has said the same thing to me. He said, email 100% of email. You know, he said email is a much better way to get to people. You should have an email. And I think maybe I'm an outlier because I ignore my email because it's too much and I can't. It's like an ocean. I feel like I'm drowning in it.
Newsletters are actually coming back big time.
Right.
And, you know, so we do a newsletter every Friday. It's either written by me or Jesse Hempel, you know, who's my colleague, a fantastic writer, or Sandra Upson, our amazing executive editor. The three of us alternate that. And we try to write something, you know, original in there that you might want to read in that newsletter there. And we've been getting a lot of great feedback. It goes out to all our followers, unless they choose not to get it in their inbox. And a sizable percentage will open those mails. We'll get comments on it. They'll interact with it like a regular story. So that's another way to reach people.
How does business?
I think that for Topolsky's site, I think that, you know, he went for being different. And so that you knew that you're at his site, which is interesting. But I think that sometimes different is not always better. I think that most people go, they want to surf the internet to de-stress, to get news, but in a way that's really calming. And I don't feel comfortable with a site that kind of gives me a sensory overload feeling that it's almost screaming at me. And I think that that's where it fails. A little bit too much is sometimes a bad thing.
This reminds me of the color scheme of the early Wired magazine, frankly.
Definitely. Definitely. I think that's definitely his model. Yeah. You know, there was just a documentary released by Red Bull, of all places, about early Wired. And I watched it, a little nostalgia trip.
Oh, yeah.
And the art director was talking about how, you know, they had this deal with this Italian press to, you know, print it on high quality paper. And, you know, they did all these exotic neon inks. And when they went, the first run came off the test and they said, that's not intense enough. And they made him pour more ink, like more cowbell. And they wanted it until it went beyond the printing press's capability to do it without smearing. They got it to the point of smearing, then dialed it back a bit.
Wow.
So it just wouldn't.
And you couldn't read it for for love or money.
You couldn't read it without getting a migraine.
But I subscribed and everybody. Were you there, Stephen, at the beginning with Lewis and Jane?
I was. I wrote the second cover story for Wired. And I, you know, back then I wanted to show it to people, you know, without giving them the whole issue. So I tried to Xerox it and my text did not show up in the Xerox. Because the whole page was like a flag with red and white.
Well, it was probably a smart way to deal with copyright. You had to buy the magazine if you wanted to read it.
Very good.
I did not know. I'm going to have to watch that documentary. I did not know that backstory that they actually, they wanted to saturate that page. Wow.
Yeah. That's a pretty cool documentary.
More is not better.
Yeah. I'll have to see that. What does Business Insider do about all this, Stephen? I know you're not responsible for, you know, driving traffic and everything, but I'm wondering, do they see it? You know, I look at BuzzFeed and Vice. I mean, BuzzFeed said, we don't think there is even a homepage will even exist anymore at some point. They believe that their primary platform is Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of distribution channels, but we're talking about this, and I just took a peek at our chart beat, and almost always, without fail, the top page being read on Business Insider is the main page. So people, thousands of people at a time are literally typing in businessinsider.com and seeing what the latest is. And I think a lot of that is a testament to we take great pains to make sure there's always something fresh and new every time you load the homepage, that there's something that you can just always come to businessinsider.com and get a snapshot of what's going on in tech and finance and business. And now of course, politics. But yeah, Facebook is a huge driver for us. Increasingly Google, because of AMP on mobile is a big deal for us now. Twitter is negligible.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think any publisher would say they get a lot of traffic from Twitter, even BuzzFeed and all those guys. And then, of course, so, I mean, it's a mix. I mean, we try to be as many places as we can and be kind of platform agnostic. And, you know, our goal is to have people enjoy the content where they are. So whether that's Facebook instant articles or clicking through from Facebook or, you know, I think we've built such a really powerful homepage that especially during our peak times, it's not unusual to have a couple thousand people just on business, you know, typing in businessinsinsider.com.
I mean, I guess
that also Business Insider has a good deal of trust. I think that right. It's going to be a rare thing for a Business Insider article to get the Facebook scarlet letter.
Oh, yeah. We're not fake news. Yeah. We don't have to worry about that.
I love that you said scarlet letter.
It's kind of what it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
So this is the latest on the fake news story. Facebook is going to, according to you guys at Back Channel, you said scarlet letter, actually, Stephen.
Yeah.
Pin a scarlet letter to fake news. What are they going to do?
So it's kind of interesting. So they were, they have this dilemma that these phony stories were getting circulation. And when you see them on Facebook, of course, something, you know, created in a Macedonian coffee house looks just as legitimate as a story from the New York Times or Back Channel or Business Insider or wherever. Some people, I guess, are affected by it. You know, we'll buy this stuff. And whether they do or not, that's the perception. And Facebook had to answer for it. But Facebook does not want to be in a position of being the arbiter of what truth is or what a legitimate publication is. So they basically outsource this problem to these fact-checking organizations who are happy to take it on for free because that's part of their mission. And I think their profile will be elevated if they do this. So there's this little system where now the people can report things if they think it's fake news. Facebook will algorithmically try to identify some of the stuff. If it passes the test, it'll get sent on to these places like Snopes or
– Help me here, though, because they've had a report fake news for a long time.
It was buried.
It's buried still on mine. I'm looking at posts.
You don't get. You don't. It isn't turned on for you yet.
Uh-huh. Report post, and then I don't know what I should do. I don't think it should be on Facebook. Continue. It's annoying. Yeah. It's pornography. It goes. Oh, finally here. Yeah. It's fake news.
Oh, there it goes. Yeah, there you go.
But that's like four layers deep.
You had to go deep. So that's the current one. But right now it comes up on the first menu. And then if you type it's a fake news story, they'll ask you whether you want to alert the person who posted it or whether you want to report it as a fake news story, in which case it'll be registered as that. And if enough people register it and it passes
Are there humans involved? So at that point, does it go to a human?
You know, it's generally an algorithmic identification there.
I get concerned. Somewhere
along the line, there could be people involved, but maybe that's the last step there. Some people were wondering whether you can like do it like a denial of service attack on these
exactly.
by just clicking. But I don't think you can. I don't think you can click on a story from the New York Times and if you're part of some sort of anti New York Times movement and then make PolitiFact check the New York Times. The algorithm will look at the publication that originated, and they'll see how old is this publication. Does this publication have followers? What's the traffic of this publication? And it'll be able to like eliminate the New York Times. I'm pretty sure that the way it's set up, that even though Facebook says it's not impossible, but I don't think any the New York Times stories or Washington Post are going to get sent off to the fake news fact checkers. It'll be interesting to see whether any Breitbart stories eventually pass that test there.
See, this is a legitimate concern because it's somewhat can be in the eye of the beholder. Go ahead, Georgia.
Right, but they're going for the.
Yeah, I think that you're right. I think that it's difficult who says what is true and what isn't. There's definitely a slippery slope that we deal with. But the reason that fake news is such an issue is that we're naturally mimics. So we see a news story. One is most people don't even read the news story. We just read the title to whatever it is.
We share before
reading. And so if we see something over and over again, eventually, unconsciously, we will believe that it's true. And I think that a lot of us like to think that we are above that and that we're very critical thinkers. But when we run through a decompression mode, we're just kind of passively absorbing things. And that's why advertising works so well. And it's a billion-dollar industry. And so the good part about what Facebook is doing is it just alerts you to say, think twice about this. So right away, we're going to look slightly more critical, especially when we're just kind of surfing the net passively. And so I think that that's a good part to that. But I think that it goes even further, because many of us will think that we are beyond having to really look at things critically because we have a certain amount of tech knowledge or we're so educated. And that's when we're more easily swayed, is when we don't think that this could be an issue in the first place.
Let me use this as an example. Citizen is going to buy Pebble for $740 million.
Right.
Not a true story, but not fake news, or is it?
Right. No. That's someone getting it wrong. You know, that's not. Yeah.
So I agree that you could probably in many cases say this is factual, this is not factual. But simply not being, this is important, not being factual does not make it fake news.
Right.
True.
And so,
what? Because you could make a litmus test that would have to do with factuality. The Pope, you know, call the Pope. Did you endorse Donald Trump? No, I did not. Okay, the Pope didn't do it. That's fake news. But it's not always just factuality. It's intent, right? And once you get
to that. Facebook told me, they said at this point, they're going for what they call bottom of the barrel hoaxes. You know, the things done, you know, with no
stuff Snopes would debunk.
Yeah, well, but Snopes also debunks things that you know they might debunk the $740 million.
That's true. That's not a hoax. But
this, at this point, Facebook is saying we're going after the bottom of the barrel, intentionally misleading hoaxes. Right. From like places that even pretend to be kind of news organizations that they're not there. So at this point, you can pretty much know it when you see it, what they're talking about. Though I don't think that solves the larger problem of truth. I think there's places you can look at. I'm going to use some right wing places, so maybe people will be unhappy with me. But, Breitbart and Fox sometimes will do things that have been debunked before they publish it, before they go with it, particularly about climate change. And, they'll, stack the deck and write things that they maybe know aren't even true. And that's another level of what some people are calling fake news, or certainly things that people don't want to see on their news feed.
Right. Facebook, Scarlet Letter. This is the little flag they're going to put on here. It's a red square with a triangle and an exclamation mark. Disputed by third-party fact checkers, then learn why this is disputed. I guess that's fair. I mean, they're not blocking it, right?
No. They're just letting you say, be a little bit more conscious of that.
I think this is going to change anything, though, because I think chiefly people share fake news not because they want it to be true, or they believe it to be true, but because it reflects a worldview they believe. And it's like it's a nod, it's a pat in the back, so it has nothing to do really with the content of the story, in my opinion. It's more a cultural thing. Which of course this doesn't hurt, I guess.
With the guy who
shot up the pizzeria gone, if he had seen that little thing on the bottom, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think this is going to stop that guy, right? He's just going to say, well, of course they're disputing it because they're in on the whole thing and they're probably child pornographers too.
No, well, I think that where it becomes important is that how does fear-based or insightful news work on our brain? So when you read something and it makes you feel an emotion of fear or worry and you feel protectionistic, you're activating your limbic system, which is like that middle reptilian part of your brain. And the problem with the reptilian system is it's highly emotional, but it's not really connected to your analytical cognitive center of your brain. And so it almost like goes into a belief system that is past analytical thought, and that's where fears and phobias come in. You might be scared of the dark, but know that nothing bad is going to happen in the dark, yet you still have this irrational fear towards it. So news stories that say, you know, this person is dangerous, or this type of media is going to melt your children's brains, without having that little tiny moniker of saying, this might not be true, immediately it creates an emotional reaction that supersedes analytical thought. And then we are a little bit more fearful of that, or at least cautious to that. You hear that enough, it becomes belief. Because that part of your brain says, you know what? We might as well be safe than sorry. And that's why this is so important, is that even the most rational of people, if you hear something enough that I should be scared of this, you might start to be cautious. And then with enough repetition, you might actually believe it.
Yeah, I think that's a small number of people, though.
You also got to keep in mind that...
No, actually, it's not, though, Leo. It's actually all of us. We have already proven that
I think that that's a misunderstanding of why this stuff gets shared. I think many of the people who share this stuff, it's not whether they believe it or not. It reflects a worldview that they believe. I also worry about what about the...
worldview usually of fear or protectionism or insightfulness. And there's a reason, probably from their own upbringing, that they have that belief system in the first place without critically thinking
Facebook
about it.
Do you want Facebook to start telling you that? And
I just think
you
that
poor little
need
person,
to...
you're living out of your limbic system. We got to help you here. That bothers the hell out of me. The last person I want telling me what my beliefs are is Mark Zuckerberg.
Well, no, that's why other people crowdsource that.
Maybe you should think twice about something isn't a bad thing. Now, I'm not saying that maybe Mark Zuckerberg should be the one that's doing it, but I think that you would be greatly, it makes it
crowdsourcing
easier.
Crowdsourcing it is also fraught with peril.
For
and,
sure.
And I worry sure about is. The Andy Borowitzes at the New Yorker and the Onion, because I think a lot of satire is also fake news.
So I disagree with that to a degree, because, should Facebook be doing this? Should Mark Zuckerberg have the say of what's true and what's not true and what's a hoax and what's not a hoax? Of course they should, because they are a major distributor of information and news. And with that comes an awesome responsibility to make sure people are getting accurate information and not just, it's dangerous. As we learned with the Pizzagate thing, it can be dangerous otherwise. And it took them a long time, or too long rather, to kind of admit to themselves, wow, we really do have this responsibility. We really do have an effect on how people think and work, and possibly an effect on elections and so forth. And it's the stuff that traditional media has done forever. Us here as the journalists on this panel do it every single day. Every single day, we're vetting stories for truth. We're vetting stories for accuracy. We're vetting stories for hoaxes. And we're vetting Trump's tweets, whether or not he's lying about millions of people illegally voting and you name it. And, there's always that discussion, is Facebook a media company? Is Google a media company? Whether they want to be or not, as a distributor of news, and a curator of news, you have a responsibility to make sure it's right. And so what this fake news button, or whatever you want to call it, does is it kind of de-emphasizes it in the algorithm too. So, hopefully it doesn't go quite as viral on the platform. And then it's also saying, hey, we edited this, we tried to vet this, and it might be fake. So, take it with a big grain of salt. So I think it's nice to see them, at least attempting to take some responsibility for all this media they're putting out there.
Yeah, I think that the Google really is the model for dealing with this. And I find it interesting. So I wrote a book about Google. I'm writing one about Facebook now. And Facebook is undergoing a lot of the things that Google did when it realized that its search engine had such power that their logical view of how it worked and how it was fair really wasn't enough for people, when they felt that it wasn't treating them fairly here. And in this case, people feel that that there's consequences from the news feed circulating these stories that don't fit the Facebook's engineering response, which would be, well, it shouldn't feel, you should basically know to take everything with a grain of salt, because it's just these people linking, right? And and it isn't all determined by an editor. And Facebook, of course, can't edit a billion stories a day. It's a difference between Business Insider, and these other places. And Facebook is that, no human being can vet all the stuff that goes through Facebook there. So they're trying to find that balance on how to do things while not stifling the voices and the desires of the people who are their customers, who come to that news feed and spend time there, which is what Facebook wants.
I worry that we get out of this an impression that every story is either true or fake, and that we can tell the difference. I mean, there are people in our chat room right now are saying, and you believe what the CIA says about Russian hacking. When do we start believing the CIA? Who's going to determine whether that's fake news or not? I just worry about algorithmic solutions. And I have to point out, Stephen, that Google is as much responsible for this as Facebook is, even to this day, partly because of AdSense. That's where these fake news sites get their revenue. And partly because search results to this day continue to pull up all sorts of spurious stuff, right?
Right, right. Well, I mean,
Google didn't solve it, did they?
Well, they didn't solve it, but there was a case, you know, the solution that Facebook has in this bottom of the barrel, effort to get the bottom of the barrel places is very similar to me than the one that Google used when it turned out that if you typed in Jew, J-E-W, in the search engine, Google didn't want to take down the site and block the site that was this anti-Semitic Holocaust denier site that came up towards the top of the results. But instead, they automatically took out an ad that would appear whenever someone pulled this up, explaining why that site showed up and what kind of site it was there. So in this case, Facebook, you could still even share something once it gets a scarlet letter, but you get a warning saying, hey, you're sharing something like that, and you know you might like to share it, you know, in which case then other people will also see the scarlet letter, which is like sewn very tightly onto the link that you can't get rid of.
Wow. Well, I see potential problems. I will have to watch and see how it's.
Well, it's a very difficult problem because again, you know, you don't want to close the newsstand down because things in the newsstand are there that you don't like.
There's a lot of fake
news. Because in the end, that could be the same thing that would happen to your point of view.
Right.
And so the danger
My
could run
point,
both ways.
Exactly. That censorship
fully,
is always a problem.
I fully agree with you on that. Yeah. I think that just giving a little moniker to think about it is a minor inconvenience and it's not actually shutting down thought. In the end, the only thing that really helps us against groupthink would be education in learning how to critically think. And right now, that's not happening enough in our school systems.
Yeah, we need to do
that. And we're becoming almost the worst. We're kind of like just wanting to get little bites of information and having them be as easily digestible as possible. And so most people are just really reading the headline anyways. Yeah.
There's a couple of interesting efforts to try to increase news literacy online. Walt Mossberg and Karen Wickrey, formerly of Google and Twitter, are involved in one. My fear, though, is anyone who would be interested in becoming more media literate is probably not the kind of person who's consuming these fake news articles.
Yeah, that's wonderfully said. I think that that's why it has to be in the school system. It's so important.
Well, I mean, there's also, I wish I could remember the name of this thesis, the evidence, you're a psychologist, you probably have read these studies, Georgia, that the evidence is that people who consider themselves well-read and literate are in fact more easily swayed.
Yes.
Because.
Yeah, that's the problem.
I'm so smart. What is that called?
It won't happen to me.
Yeah. I'm so smart. I don't fall for fake news.
Intelligence
people, right?
Oh, that's we another all kind have. Of smart. We all have.
Okay. Tomorrow we're interviewing Tim Wu, whose new book is called The Attention Merchants. In the book, he talks about the first fake news, which actually goes back to the first newspaper in 1862, where there was a real newspaper war going on in New York. Newspapers were expensive at first, didn't make a lot of money. And a couple of publishers came along. I don't remember the names. I'll have it for you tomorrow because it's in the book. I think it was the New York Sun.
Benjamin Day,
who said, well, first of all, we're going to charge a penny, which is a loss, but we're going to make the money up in display ads. And in order to boost circulation, made up a story about telescopes seeing the people on the moon and describing the people who lived on the moon and the houses that they had. And it was a sensation, sold papers like crazy. Fake news is as old as mass media. Literally.
I would say it's even older because you can take a look at cave paintings of unicorns and okay, of aliens coming down. And if you take a look at the graffiti in Pompeii, which is a fascinating read, it is all spreading of certain belief systems of different people and anger towards the government.
Right.
And so I think that fake news is as old as humanity, really.
And so I ultimately fear that this is another witch hunt. And it really is about censorship from the left as opposed to censorship from the right, but censorship all the same. And I really worry that that opens a slippery slope, a bad precedent. But I also think that there is a problem with fake news. I think you're right that I think it does influence people. So I don't know what the answer is. I also wish that we didn't get so much of our news from Facebook, but that's another problem entirely. Where are you going to go though? See, I'm one of those people who reads all the different sources, so I know what's going on.
I'm waiting for the first report of someone who said, man, if I had known that Hillary was not a demon, I would have voted for her.
Here's the article. Thank you, Bleak, in the chat room. Why smart people are stupid. This is Jonah Lehrer in The New Yorker. Jonah Lehrer was writing originally for the Wall Street Journal. And
Jonah Lehrer?
Yeah. Is that interesting?
Wow.
Yeah, this goes back to 2012.
Right. I guess that people believed him, right? That
he was a famous fabricator, right? that's a good point. But he does talk about Daniel Kahneman, who professor of psychology at Princeton, who was the one who came up with this evidence that people who think they're smart people. Suggested that smart people are more vulnerable to thinking errors because we think intelligence is a buffer against bias, but it's actually a subtle curse. And consider the source, though, because Jonah Lehrer was also involved a little bit in fake news.
Well, not fake, but apparently
enhanced.
Apparently, Michael Lewis's book on Kahneman and his partner is fantastic.
That's where I had just read this, was it Michael Lewis. That's what I was trying to remember, yeah. Very interesting. And it was also done at the University of Toronto. So sometimes bias is very hard to detect. Let's just leave it at that. We're going to take a break and come back with more. We had a great week this week. Lots of fun at Twit, and we've made a little promo to give you a peek at the highlights, just in case you missed some, watch.
Okay, Google, turn off the Christmas tree inside.
Oh, that just happened! Oh, my God!
Okay, Google, turn on the Christmas tree inside.
Okay. No! It happened again!
This week in Google.
I have a little something-something.
Oh, you got it? You didn't have to stand in line?
Spectacles.
I took advantage of this thing called eBay. I like the idea. I've heard that streaming live video is all the rage these days. So I was thinking maybe I should do some of that.
Know-how.
The Microsoft Surface Studio is a beautiful computer, but over the last few weeks, one deficiency has become glaringly clear. The storage performance is wanting. Upgrading the drives on the Surface Studio isn't hard, but it does require the removal of 32 screws and bolts in about 50 steps. With our new Surface SSD Studio, we benched about 540 megabytes per second read and 500 megabytes per second write. For those keeping score, that's a little bit faster.
Twit. Tech just like you like it.
Served fish. But you didn't have the black hard rubber Western Electric phones that we all had.
No.
And with the dials.
Nor did I have telegrams.
I have Snapchat spectacles. I know I'm old. I'm snapping right now. My God, what more do you need? I'm cool. Okay, let me upload that to my story. great week ahead. Let's see what they'll be covering on TNT this week.
Thanks, Leo. This week we celebrate Festivus, the holiday that's been around since the ancient Seinfeld times. Among other things, Festivus is a time to air your grievances, so it's only appropriate that this week's big stories include some of the largest tech grievances of the year. First, for all you Galaxy Note 7 loyalists out there, Samsung is pushing out an update on Monday, December 19th that will prevent your recalled device from charging and eliminate the ability for it to work as a mobile device. Depending on your carrier, that update might not be pushed out until the end of December or early January. But either way, it's time to bring it back to the store, my friends. It's time. According to Mac Rumors, Apple will begin selling their wireless AirPods in stores on Monday, December 19th, just in time for the holidays, if you've waited until the last minute to shop for the holidays. And don't forget to use NORAD's Santa Tracker this week to track the old man on his way to delivering all the good stuff. And speaking of holidays, TNT will be here all week, and Jason Howell and I will cover all this news and a whole lot more every day at 4 p.m. Pacific. That's the week ahead. Back to you, Leo.
Thank you, Megan Maroney. TNT Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 2400 UTC. By the way, there is a Santa Tracker schism. I hope you know that. NORAD and Google went their separate ways, and Google now has its own Santa Tracker that is not with NORAD. So pick your
drama.
Pick wisely. Decide which Santa Tracker. I think the results are roughly the same, though. I just want to point that out. I'm going to ask you about those AirPods. Shut up. I'm not asking you, computer. Stupid computer. I'm going to ask you about those AirPods.
I thought that was me.
No. It's this.
Everyone's checking.
Windows just doesn't like to be ignored for too long. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, you have an update. Come on, do it now.
Hey, come on, touch me, touch me. I dare you to touch me. This Week in Tech brought to you today by GoToMeeting. Why do a phone conference call? They're so bland, they're so boring, they're so two-dimensional when you could go high-tech with GoToMeeting. Now, what's great is it can be a stealth phone bridge. So you could start a GoToMeeting, and it's easier than anything because you just click a link. They have a plugin for Outlook. You just send it, sends an email out to your client or your colleague. They click the link when the time comes. If they don't have the software, it's installed automatically and quickly. And they're there. They're ready. And you can be just, you know, talking to each other, just like a conference call. But then, you know, you could slip this in. You could sneak it in. You could say, hey, I'd like to show you my PowerPoint presentation. Would you mind? And then, boom, all of a sudden, he's seeing your screen. You're sharing the PowerPoint. You're showing the document. You can collaborate on the document. And then you could say, you know, I wonder how you're liking this. Would you mind? Turn on your camera. I'd like to see your reaction, and I'll turn on mine. And suddenly, you've got crystal clear HD video. And this is not just a conference call, my friends. This is an engaging, effective, efficient meeting, whether it's a sales demonstration, a presentation, a collaboration, an ad hoc meeting. I know teams that stay on GoToMeeting most of the day because they're all over the world, and that's how they stay in touch. 9 out of 10 GoToMeeting users agree they close deals more than 20% faster. And you can do it too right now, free at GoToMeeting.com. Don't phone it in. Start your free trial at GoToMeeting.com. And you see right there the orange button. Just click that and you're good to go. Why do a conference call when you do GoToMeeting? We're talking about the week's tech news. Stephen Levy is here from BackChannel.com. One of the last two people who used to go to Bill Gates' pajama party or something. If I've not misunderstood it, Markoff is now retired, too. You're the last one. Last man standing, Stephen Levy. Also with us, Georgia Dow from iMore.com. Great to have you. She's a psychotherapist, so you can trust her when she talks about your brain. And Mr. Steve Kovac from the Business Insider. Great to have all three of you. All from the East Coast, where you're being vortexed. Are you from the West Coast?
No.
Why did I think you were in New York?
No, I'm in New York.
Yeah, that's the East Coast.
East Coast is the best coast, though. No, we're done with the polar vortex. It was almost 60 today.
Whoa,
yeah.
Good. I'm flying out there to see my mom in a couple of days after Christmas. Verizon has decided, by the way, Megan had the story that on Monday, your Note 7, if you still have one, and apparently over 100,000 people in the United States have not turned in their Note 7, Samsung sending out an update that will mean you can't use it unless it's plugged in. Verizon said at first, no, we're not going to do that. It's Christmas. Everybody has the right to have a fire at Christmas. Even CeeLo, right? Did CeeLo's Note 7 blow up late? Somebody was saying that. Verizon was going to block that update. Now they say, all right. We'll do it. Verizon's going to brick your Note 7 January 5th. T-Mobile, December 27th, AT&T, January 5th. Sprint will be the one that keeps your Note 7 going the longest, January 8th. Imagine the liability, though, if, you know, you're Sprint and somebody has a fire on New Year's night.
You don't need a Yule time log.
Yeah. Keep it in the fireplace. That's actually a good idea. Just keep your Note 7 in the fireplace. That's kind of this. That really was one of the big stories of the year. Is just the
you could gift it to someone you don't like, right?
Yeah,
right.
Here's a Note 7.
You get a Note 7, know that that person doesn't really care about you.
So I had said that I don't think that these are exploding anymore, but apparently CeeLo Green, who is a well-known musician and producer, according to surveillance footage, security footage, was nearly killed. Is this fake news? Fake!
I don't even know what the site that is.
It was staged. Yeah. Oh, man. I fell for fake news. But look, I have video.
I would call that satire.
Yeah, that's the problem. What is it? Satire? Here he is. He's in his studio. The security camera's on. CeeLo Green, he's there. He's talking on his Note 7. When watch, he's got it right up to his head. This looks real to me, folks. Well, wait a minute. Now he's rolling closer to the camera. That worries me. Maybe that's it. Oh, my God. Oh. It exploded, and he's lying on the floor, motionless. Okay, apparently this was staged.
That's when someone needs more press.
Why didn't Facebook flag this? We have a game we play at home with the kid when we watch YouTube videos, real or staged. And I notice he gets it wrong every time. Mm. Although occasionally I will think it's real and it's staged. Most of it's almost all of it's fake, by the way.
How do you find out?
I don't know.
Scarlet letter.
I don't know. How do you find out?
Without that scarlet letter, what do we do?
I mean,
if you have to ask, it's fake.
Yeah, maybe that's true. So some big changes at Google.
That's the problem is that with people are getting better at making things look really authentic.
Yeah. Hmm. Yes. Well, you saw the very funny. There were a couple of funny takeoffs on. What was that holiday? Love Actually. Where he goes at the end of the movie and he says, he comes to knocks on the door and she comes to the door and he says, shh, tell him it's carolers. And he plays Christmas carol music and then shows her the title cards. So there have been a number of fakes. One was Putin coming to see Donald Trump and Putin says, shh, tell her it's Crooked Hillary. And Trump shouts to Melania, it's okay, it's Crooked Hillary. And then I saw another one.
Saturday Night Live did one last night.
With Hillary coming to an elector's door.
Yeah.
That was good. That was hilarious.
Actually very funny.
Yeah.
I believed them both. I thought they were real. I didn't know. So let's talk about what's going on at Google since we've got Stephen Levy, who knows everything. He's got very good sources inside of Google. One thing I'm hearing from a lot of Googlers and people who know Googlers is, I'll put it in bluntly, so to speak, that Larry Page and Sergey Brin are off kind of in space, not paying that much attention. That Ruth Porat, the new CFO, is just cutting and slashing, hacking and hewing, and reorganizing Google on better financial basis. Does that sound accurate to you? Because we do see a lot of changes over there.
Well, there's a lot of changes. You know, the Alphabet thing, I think the jury's still out. I never was in love with it. I think that
splitting Google up into one big holding company called Alphabet with lots of little companies, Google being its own company run by Sundar Pichai.
The bets, Google is the alpha company and the rest of them are the bets, right? And it just changes the character of those companies. It used to be that the whole was more than the sum of the parts.
Right.
Now parts all have to be, you know, accounted for there. So they almost went in the direction there. So for something like Fiber, it had a mission before, which success was in terms of building the number of people who can get the internet and then use Google. Now that they're asking it to sort of be a business on its own, it isn't doing that great. So that's a key example. And then the other thing it was supposed to do was give the CEOs more autonomy and power. And now we're seeing all these CEOs falling off because maybe Google didn't like the way they used the power. They were ticking off people there. So I don't think Larry is totally checked out from what I hear. I think that in some ways he really likes the structure that he can zoom in and pay attention to the things that he cares about. I think that, Google itself is sort of recreated, the Google part of Google has sort of recreated itself by taking on aspects that used to be part of, say, X, right? So now there's like a research division within Google itself, and the virtual reality is in Google itself. So, eventually will Google be spinning off companies of its own? Will they become Alphabet Bets, or will they be, just part of, like an Uber Google there, because Sundar is doing, such a good job. Everyone thinks that, he's killing it there. So it's an interesting time for the company. But meanwhile, look, the revenue and the business model keeps everything afloat.
Google's a great engine, right? I mean, there's no question about it. They're going to spin off the self-driving car. They've got a name for the company. It's going to be called Waymo. Apparently, the change here is that Google's not going to build their own. They're doing a deal with Fiat Chrysler to make cars, and that the cars will probably have steering wheels. Famously,
they have to.
By law.
Say again, Steve.
Oh, I was just saying that's by law.
By law, yeah.
Yeah, Google's very unhappy. They have to build steering wheels in there. They have this plan that they would send those, like little bugs out there, around Mountain View and take people from one campus to another. And they're very unhappy that they have to put steering wheels in them.
The information also says that Google wants to launch a company called Chauffeur, which will be a taxi or commercial ride sharing service by the end of next year.
Yeah, Chauffeur was actually the code name for the whole Google car project.
Ah, robo taxi service. This is Uber. Maybe this is why Uber is rushing to get its robo taxis out. Maybe they see Chauffeur coming up behind them. Also, let's see what else has changed in Google. There's Calico, which is the anti-aging spinoff. That one seems to be doing okay. They have $1.5 billion in the bank, according to Antonio Regalado, writing for the MIT Technology Review.
Yeah, I think it's interesting how they measure success for different bets, because obviously fiber they see as more of a shorter term. They want to see something material in the shorter term, whereas something like Calico, where they're literally trying to stop us from dying or get us to living to age 400 or whatever. They realize that's not going to happen tomorrow. That's going to take years or decades of research. Right. And they might not even get there. So it's kind of interesting to hear how, you want to talk about Ruth Porat, digging into these companies and setting goals and so forth. Like Calico's not making any money, but their mission is more way out there. So that's pretty interesting too. And I kind of want to hear what Steven has to say about this. Just what are Larry and Sergey focused on out of all these other bets? Like, what's your impression of, are they more into, they're clearly just totally disconnected from regular Google, are they more into things like Sidewalk Labs? Are they more into these, crazy other bets like curing death? I mean, what's your impression, Steven?
Well, Sergey, spends most of his time at X,
the moonshot.
And Larry, from what I hear, is also super interested in that. I know he has interest, he watches things like Sidewalk. Calico is interesting because like life sciences, which does have some revenue stream, what Calico possibly could do is if some of the scientists, make one, breakthrough that maybe won't make us live to 1,000 years old, but could, make us look better, 10 years, for 10 more years, as we get older, because it's all about stopping aging. That's like a multi-billion-dollar drug, right? So just the prospect of one of those things could wind up being a pretty hefty revenue stream.
It's the Holy Grail, right? And
you don't have to get the Grail in order to make some money there. Even something that could stave off the Reaper were, make you feel younger for, a decade or two, little, pieces of the Grail could be pretty profitable.
Exceptionally Maybe profitable. Come up with it's one of those areas where, you can't, time is one of those things that we can't stop. It comes for all of us. And so, yes, the same thing with aging or just looking better, though it's funny that you said that because the naked mole rat is probably one of the least attractive of creatures on the planet. I'm sure there's some more that are in contention for it. But they also have like cancer resistant properties, and they're also impervious to certain types of pain. So it's not even just that. It's also quality of life that they can improve upon.
I'd rather die than look like a naked mole rat.
Don't they have interesting social...
They have a high quality of life, I hear, actually.
They live in a colony ruled by a queen. It's similar to the Borg, really.
Yeah.
Nice.
They have an interesting social arrangement.
Yeah. Give me death.
Give me death. Or give me naked mole rats. What else? What else is going on at Google? Android Things is their new name for their IoT stuff, bringing Brillo and Weave together under one roof. I would love to see one company, Google or Apple or somebody, kind of make some sort of progress in this IoT space to kind of bring everything together. We have all these protocols and companies, and nothing works with anything else, and it's just a mess.
Right. Well, now what supposedly we should bind them together is all these voice products like Echo,
right,
and now Google Home and things like that. So the place where you command them might be the glue. But of course, there's like about five companies that want to be that central hub.
Right. Well, maybe Amazon's got a little lead. Apparently, the Wynn Resorts in Las Vegas are putting in Echoes in every room. 4,748 hotel rooms. I was wondering, well, if you order something, where does the product go? Well, apparently, it's all Steve Wynn's account. So go ahead and buy Steve some cashmere socks and have fun. Actually, I think this is a good idea. And boy, it's good for Amazon because it'll introduce people, a lot of people, to the Echo who probably have never tried it before.
So am I the only one that thought that's the first thing that I would unplug if I was staying in a
room? Why would you unplug it?
Because it's creepy. I go to a hotel, one is I want to be unplugged, but two is that I want to have control over what's being listened to while I'm there.
Well, at least so it's sitting out in the open. You don't know what they've got in the walls.
Well, I assume that would be legal versus putting something out in the open, which would be legal. So there's even a greater chance that
that's interesting. No,
would feel comfortable.
So would it be, so if you put an Echo in there, is that presumed consent then if you listen in on the Echo? No.
Yeah, well, no, but it's assumed consent that you don't mind the you would have to be okay with the privacy policy that Amazon already puts out.
And well, I have Echoes in every room of my house.
But Leo, you also live most of your life online. Like you're almost always here, so you're kind of already very comfortable with people knowing a lot about your private life.
Well, nobody's listening to my Echo conversation.
You're very private when you're out off of camera.
Nobody's listening to your Echo stream. You think it's on all the time and somebody at Amazon is sitting there. Hey, let's hear what's going on at the Dow House.
They are. The thing is that if they wanted to, they could.
Yeah.
And there's a difference between both.
Okay, I guess that's true. In fact, Evernote got in a little bit of hot water this week because they announced a new privacy policy, something that had always been true, that Evernote employees could look at your notes and might from time to time. That really upset people. So they took it back out of the privacy policy without changing the ultimate fact that, of course, they still can at any time look at your notes because they're storing them. That's called cloud. We didn't mention the Yahoo hack. Actually, before we get to that, I do want to, since we were talking about Google, talk about something Google has a big investment in. But of late, there may be people saying that the emperor has new clothes. And I'm talking about Magic Leap. Have any of you gone to see the Magic Leap demo?
I wish.
Yeah. I mean, Kevin Kelly did a whole story on it in Wired and talked a lot about it and how amazing it was. And they've raised a ton of money. But now it turns out, according to some, that maybe this technology isn't near ready for prime time. That it looks a little more like this than the HoloLens, another augmented reality project that's a little bit farther along. And in fact, according to one report, it's not even as good as HoloLens. It still requires you wired up to a massive computer. It looks like apparently Magic Leap might have made a bet on a technology that hasn't really paid off.
Yeah, it sounds like the first thing they're going to release is going to be kind of like a watered down version of what they've been showing people in demos and been showing investors. And, you know, thousands of people, or maybe a thousand or so, have tried it under NDA. So even if they have used it, they can't really talk about the experience publicly. But, you know, I hate the Theranos comparison for anything now. Not, so, I mean, I feel like, yeah, it's not that. It's
Theranos just, was in all likelihood in a kind of an intentional ruse. You don't think Magic Leap is tricking anybody?
I don't think they're, I don't think they're intentionally.
Yeah, the Theranos thing is a crazy comparison. I mean, the investors in Magic Leap are the most savvy tech investors on the planet. You know, Sundar Pichai is on the board. You know, they have other, you know, super knowledgeable tech investors. If Magic Leap doesn't succeed, then, you know, look, they went and gave a shot at it. I personally can't say whether or not I've seen it, but
Have you seen it? You've totally seen it.
He's been NDA'd. All right.
But I can't say. But I think what's happened in the past couple of weeks has been a little nuts. You know, The Information did a story on it. The Information story was not a story which was the equivalent to the Wall Street Journal Theranos story. It didn't have wrongdoing. There wasn't like deception. It showed, you know, what a lot of people knew, that they weren't moving as fast as they hoped.
Right? And these things happen. There is one accusation in the Information story that is not great, which is this video that was made and used apparently to recruit employees, just another day at the office of Magic Leap. And it turns out it was created. In fact, it even says on the stamp here, at the Weta workshop, the folks who did the special effects for The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, and it is completely whole cloth. This is not using the Magic Leap technology at all. This is special effects.
Yeah, no, I think it's clear to anyone that that's not what happens when you go to work at Magic Leap, that that's the way you do your work. So I think if that's the smoking gun, you know, big deal. I mean, it was a solidly written story, but I think what was more interesting to me was the way that Magic Leap responded to the story, which Roni, Abramowitz, the CEO, has gone into he's gone a little Twitter mad, trying to defend Magic Leap there. And I think, you know, maybe he would be doing better off holding his powder and, you know, waiting until he had something to show, whenever that is. You know, contacting his investors and assuring them that he's going to be able to eventually do the launch and then and improve on it and win the long game, which this really is. You know, I think that right now, if you follow him on Twitter, you're going to get a lot of tweets.
These things happen. I mean, in fact, as all these investors know, and they've poured more than $1 billion into Magic Leap, sometimes you make a bet. It's a high risk, high reward bet. Maybe it takes longer. Maybe it doesn't ever happen. But that doesn't mean it's malicious. It just means that, you know, they're trying something difficult.
I think it's also just way too soon to judge something most people haven't seen publicly, that they haven't done a public demonstration of. And I think the reason why there's so much interest is they've been hyping it up for years. I mean, you know, which beyond the money that they've attracted, you know, cover story in Wired, cover story on Forbes, you know, this is the future, and, you know, glowing profiles that don't really say very much. That, you know,
what I mean. It feels a little like it's overhyped. Yeah.
It lumps a lot of expectations on the company between the amount they've raised and, you know, these glitzy magazine stories on them that, you know, are light on, you know, meat. There's no meat to, like, what's really going on there. So it's no wonder why, you know, the Information wanted to poke around and see, you know, what the heck's going on. You know, I think it's rightful to be a little bit skeptical. But again, no one's really tried it, and they don't have their final.
They're not asking you to go buy one now.
Right.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. No, it's no skin off my nose. I just, you know, I also think it's suspicious when a company will show it to people, but then insist that you're not, that you not talk about it. And it's one of the reasons I don't do any NDAs, because I feel like that's, it doesn't help me. It doesn't help my audience if I know something that I can't tell them. It's, you know, so, and it feels like, well, okay, why are you showing me this then? Who are you trying, whose hearts and minds are you trying to win here?
Anyway. They have to walk a very careful line, because they want to be able to build up press and interest so that they can make a certain amount of money that they need in order to invest and to develop. But then you also end up with your audience having what could end up being expectational debt. And that's when you have oversold something and you underdeliver, and then people end up really angry and upset with something that they expected would be mind-blowing and ended up being pretty awesome, but for the fact that you expected the world.
They also have 800 employees, which is a lot for a product that may not emerge for years.
And they're also losing people. I mean, they lost, I mean, you want to talk about the press coverage that they've had. They've lost their chief marketing officer, and they've lost their head of comms in the past. This week, they lost their head of comms, and a month or two ago, they lost their chief marketing officer. And, you know, they're not, there's nothing to even communicate or market yet. So you got to wonder what's going on there. And why are they losing, you know, that side of the business? And they've lost a lot of other employees too. And those are the people chatting to the press right now.
Okay, so maybe there's no fire, but there's a lot of smoke. I just thought I'd bring it up. You're right. None of us have lost any money, and the people who are putting money into it are smart and know what they're doing, I would assume. Let's take a break. Final thoughts. I do want to talk about that latest Yahoo news. Holy cow. And whether Verizon is going to keep buying. I don't know what's going to happen with the if Verizon does pull out of the deal, which I'm sure at this point it could, what happens to Yahoo? But first, a word from our sponsor. Audible is my audiobook store. I love it. I've been an Audible listener since the year 2000. That's when I started listening. I've always loved audiobooks. I love the idea of somebody reading to me. I learn so much, and there's always times in the day when I can't hold a book, but I can listen to a book. When you're in your commute, when you're at the gym, when you're walking the dog, washing the dishes, whatever it is you're doing, it's really nice. And I, you know, talk about the Amazon Echo, it will read to me. I could say, Echo, read to me. And it picks up where I left off on my most recent book automatically. I love Audible. We're going to get you two free books right now if you go to audible.com/twit and the number 2. There's some really good books in here. Everybody's raving. I haven't read it yet, about Trevor Noah, the host of The Daily Show's new book, Born a Crime. He narrates it. I think that's always great. Leonard Cohen passed this year. This is the biography to read, I'm Your Man. It's available at audible.com. You want to really get into some heavy history? 57 hours and 13 minutes, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. I have to say, I read this in paper. I love this. Audible has so many great books, all the bestsellers, classics, science fiction, history, biography. Here's a little something called Hackers, Heroes of the Computer Revolution. If you haven't read Stephen Levy's classic, you got to read it. They have, I think, do they have all of your books? I'm sure they do. Let's see here. In the Plex, that's the book on Google. Really a good read. I actually listened to that. Insanely Great, The Life and Times of the Macintosh. I think I listened to that. I know I listened to The Perfect Thing, How the iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and Coolness. There's good stuff.
I narrated The Insanely Great. That was the one I read.
The one that you're never going to, and you're never going to do again, right? That's a lot of work, isn't it?
The good thing was it was about 10 years after I wrote it. So to me, what it was horrible is if you have to read a book that you just wrote, it's like torture because you're sick of it by then.
And, yeah.
You know, you've gone over it 50 times and copy edits and things like that. You think it's horrible. So to sit in a studio for 4 days and read it would be torture to me.
But this was fun. It was like visiting an old friend.
Yeah.
And we should mention that since we were talking about John Markoff, I wonder if, yes, Machines of Loving Grace is at Audible. This is a wonderful book. John Markoff's written so many great books about the tech revolution. That's probably the classic. He also wrote What the Dormouse Said. I wonder if they've got that. They've got a lot of have his New York Times pieces here as well. That's another thing you get, by the way, if you go to audible.com/twit2, is the daily digest of the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times read to you. I guess they don't have his book about the Dormouse. That was him, right? Or was it Katie Hafner who wrote that? Anyway, there are great books at Audible, and you must join, and you must take advantage of our offer. You're going to go to audible.com/twit2. You'll be signing up for the Platinum account. That's a subscription account that gives you 2 books a month. That's what I do, and it's the easiest way to just kind of build up your library. I should show you my library, hundreds of books. In fact, I'm going to do a blog post. I did a blog post a year ago on everything that I had listened to in 15 years of Audible, but I have to update it now with the books from this year, and there's so many great books, and I want to give you links to all of them, so I'll do that on my blog. I'm reading right now, and I'm sure, Georgia Dow, you probably read this in your studies, Man's Search for Meaning by the legendary Viennese psychiatrist Viktor Frankl, the story of his internment at Auschwitz, and it's unbelievable.
I haven't actually read it. I've followed pieces, but I haven't actually read the book. You'll have to tell me how it is.
Yeah, he created logotherapy, and it was based on his shortly after he got out of Auschwitz, based on his experiences there. And it's just, well, it's powerful, I guess is the best word for it. But this is the beauty of Audible. You get great experiences. You know, it's almost like you're there when they're reading to you. There's something about the way you're taking it in. Here's the book you were talking about, Stephen. The Undoing Project, A Friendship That Changed Our Minds. This is about David Kahneman and Amos Tversky's studies about the decision-making process. Michael Lewis is so great. He always picks fascinating subjects. This is his most recent. All of his books are also on Audible. So, look, pick two and get them free. You cancel in the first 30 days. You'll pay nothing, and the books will be yours to keep. Audible.com/twit2. I've just given you so many books to get. I don't know. You know what's funny is now I'm adding that because I have a wish list on Audible that's got about 80 books on it. I'm going to add that to the list because I want to read that too. That's the book about the Kahneman stuff. All right. Yahoo. It's just one thing after another with Yahoo, isn't it? Now they say that one, and I think it's a story just because of the number, 1 billion user accounts have been breached. This happened a few years ago. Remember that, of course, earlier Yahoo had revealed that 500 million accounts had been breached in a separate hack. At this point, you got to wonder, is Verizon going to go through with the deal? What happens to Yahoo next?
We had AOL CEO Tim Armstrong, who's kind of helping spearhead that deal, at our conference a week and a half ago now. And this was before the disclosure of the hack. And we asked him, my colleague asked him point blank, like, you know, put a number on this. What's the percentage chance that this happens? And he wouldn't do that. But he's like, I'm cautiously optimistic that the deal is going to go through. Week later, this happens. So, it's either going to be a discount. You got to think they're still.
Well, they asked for
Yahoo,
a billion off. Verizon already asked for a billion off for the first hack. And actually,
exactly.
What's really important is what did Marissa Meyer know and when did she know it? What did she hide this material information from Verizon and other suitors when they were selling the company? And there's some evidence that she did on the 2014 hack. This billion account hack happened a year earlier. So it would stretch credulity to think that Marissa Meyer did not know about this billion account hack from 2013.
I'm just shocked that many people still use Yahoo.
I know. That was the other thing. A billion people? Really? Names, email addresses, telephone numbers,
really?
Dates of birth, passwords. The company says it thinks it's distinct from the 2014 hack. And it says, and the hackers aren't in our network anymore. So they say. I don't know.
Yeah.
What do you think? If Verizon pulls out, maybe they'll just ask for another billion off. What happens?
Yeah, there's still a lot of value in Yahoo, right? Yeah. Because of Alibaba, Yahoo Japan, and all that kind of stuff. I mean, there's
well, you don't get the Alibaba stake with the
Alibaba. Yeah, that's true. But you know, there is a lot of value still tied up in there, and they do have a massive user base. So, I mean, it's, and especially for what AOL wants to do with it, well, it makes sense.
We do know they have a massive user base, but how much longer?
Yahoo.com is, that's how a lot of people get their news. You want to talk about visiting a home page for getting your news. True. Yahoo is my massive.
Yahoo. I used my Yahoo for years as my home page. I'm happy to say I've grown out of it, but it was my home page. I think we can wrap things up. Is there anything I missed that you wanted to talk about? Twitter? So. Anything to say about Twitter? Anything to say about drones, virtual reality? Oh, AirPods. You got them.
Oh, yeah. Here. Boom.
You got them. You went to the store. Oh, no. They sent you review units.
The review unit. Yeah.
Yeah, we've seen the pre-production review units. Renee Ritchie had those and others. Like it?
Yeah, they're okay. I mean, so the production ones had a lot of issues, probably mostly related to the software. You know, Apple told me ahead of time, before you try these, make sure you have the latest iOS update and before you start rocking them. But, you know, before I had issues like if I was listening to music and someone called me and I answered the call, like the audio wouldn't carry over and it would just get all screwed up and things like that. That seems to mostly have been fixed. My big problem, I just have two issues with them. And one, they look really goofy when you wear them. And two is the control mechanisms. It's really annoying to adjust the volume and switch tracks when you're listening to music. You have to enable
Siri. Are you supposed to talk to Siri?
So, like, you know, if I want to turn up the volume, I double tap it, say, Siri, raise the volume, and then the music stops and then plays again with a higher volume. That's just awkward. I mean, you know, yes, you can use your watch, and yes, you can, you know, just physically touch on the phone, but that little dongle on the wired earbuds were so nice, and, you know, it seems like they didn't really figure out a solution to replace that. But other than that, they're cool. Battery life is great. Yeah, they're neat.
Apple's getting a little heat, too, because of their Mac OS update of Sierra 10.12.2. People were complaining about the new MacBook Pros, including Walt Mossberg, about the new MacBook Pro's battery life fluctuating wildly. So Apple did fix that. They removed the time remaining estimate.
I love this story.
Now you just don't know.
Yeah. You can't trust it, so we'll just take it out.
It's like the North Carolina legislature said you weren't allowed. Their own state employees weren't allowed to talk about climate change.
Right.
Right. So when the
ignore that.
When the coast got flooded, you know, all the time they'd have to say, you know, there's a little water.
These things happen.
Right. Right. Can we talk about the new emoji for a second?
Yes, the iOS 10.2 is out, and we now have many attractive, new, almost good enough to eat emojis. What are your favorites?
There's the bacon. The bacon's really cute. Mm. I like the face plant, the one that's being sick.
The face palm?
Yeah, that's
not a face plant. Cute. That's where you put your face on the
palm.
Side.
Sorry, my Canadian. I apologize.
I don't think they have a face plant emoji, although that would be okay. But no, it's like, I could have had a V8. Yeah. I could have had a V8, yeah.
Right.
We talk about the creepy clown.
The creepy clown.
Yes.
Whoa.
Yeah, that's the thing is that emoji used to be a safe place. but no more. For those of us that are suffering from chlorophobia, which is the fear of clowns.
What's it called?
Chlorophobia.
See, how do you spell that?
Okay, I'll try. C-L-O-U-R-O-P-H-O-B-I-A. I'm dyslexic, Leo. Don't ask me how to spell anything.
Chlorophobia. Wow. I never knew that.
Yeah, it's the fear of clowns.
So there's a disco guy. There's a Mrs. Claus. This is from Emojipedia. There's a pregnant lady. Not a pregnant man, though.
A really creepy clown.
Yeah, I don't really understand the creepy clown. Like, who was begging for a creepy clown? But maybe that's, you know, most of us have chlorophobia.
Do they have the crooked Hillary?
No. By the way, that's a funny story. The crooked Hillary emoji that the Trump campaign was asking for was, what, a couple of bags of cash? And then they wanted to simplify it to just a person running off with a bag of cash. And Twitter, I think quite rightly, said, you can't have a custom emoji. What are you talking about? And then Jack Dorsey's glad he did because he didn't have to go to that tech summit. Here, let me see if I can get the clown for you. This is a video of all of the new emoji. Apple has decided to make these kind of almost realistic, at least with the food. The humans aren't so much. And thanks to Google, by the way, for creating male and female. Whoa, that's a singer looking like Bowie. New male and female for all the occupations. Google kind of demanded that, and rightly so. Health worker. Here's the lying face, a Pinocchio nose, sneezing face with a handkerchief to the nose.
Oh, I thought that that guy was trying to sniff a ghost.
Yes, I thought so too. Drooling face, rolling on the floor laughing, which is a slightly rolling face with cowboy. Here comes, stand back, watch out. Here comes, if you got chlorophobia.
Warning.
It looks like an ice cream cake. Are you really scared of that? It doesn't look harmless.
Not that one, but still,
These are the Apple versions, but these are actually part of the new standard. You will see these on most platforms sooner or later. Georgia Dow, there you go. So there's a Google clown is not quite so bad. The Microsoft clown looks like it's made out of Play-Doh. Mm-hmm. I think the Apple one is the scariest for sure. Thank you, Georgia Dow. imore.com. Don't forget her videos at anxiety-videos.com. Great stuff, not just on anxiety, but sleep and getting your head together. Some really great, encouraging videos. You do a great job. It's always wonderful to see you. Thank you for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Steve Kovac is a senior correspondent at Business Insider. That means you don't have to carry a red pencil with you. You just write.
This is true.
You let other people edit.
Thank goodness.
At Steve Kovac on the Twitter. And, of course, Stephen Levy. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. StephenLevy.com.
Thank you.
Backchannel.com. Do you all tweet? I mean, should I give your Twitter handles? Because you all tweet. Stephen Kovac.
One thing I do is tweet.
Really?
Yeah, I don't use Facebook or Snapchat. Instagram.
I like Facebook better than Twitter. I feel like Twitter is just too fragmented, too hard to follow, too strange. But I do follow Donald Trump, I have to say, because it's just fascinating. I can't take my eyes off his Twitter feed.
That's one word to say, fascinating.
Don't you find it like, wow, I can't stop reading it.
Yeah.
What
just incites rage in me, I think. That's next? The big thing.
Well, I'm trying not to be raging.
Yeah.
I'm trying to just be sanguine about the whole thing and just kind of understand. But those tweets, wow.
Unprecedented.
I loved that. Yeah. It's a shame they fixed that.
Well said.
You know, he tweeted unprecedented, the misspelling where he said that Chinese stole our drone, and this is unprecedented, with an S, came from an Android phone middle of the night. Next morning, fixed from an iPhone, confirming what many have long said, which is when Trump tweets, it's usually late at night from an Android device. And when his staff tweets, it's the next morning on an iPhone. Just a little, you know, it's helpful to have these glosses to understand better what's going on. It's unprecedented. Thank you all for being here. We do. This is our last twit of 2016. We'll be back January 8th. But there will be fresh twits for you. Next week, we're going to do a holiday seasonal twit where we get some of our favorite hosts in the studio that aren't normally in studio. Steve Gibson, Denise Howell, Renee Ritchie. And we'll talk about all the big tech stories of 2016. And then the following week, our best of. Thanks to you. You've been submitting all these great bits from the previous episodes. And we've edited them together into a fun a couple of hours of the best of Twit 2016. That'll be...
Tell me they have you with the plants.
Oh, I think they start with that. You mean where I got naked? Yeah.
Yes.
You were there for that.
That was so great. That was so great. That was the funniest
That's
thing.
That's one word for it.
No, I didn't mean that insulting. It was just...
It was
no
definitely unpresidential. that's going to be on that's New Year's Day. Christmas Day, of course, is the holiday show. And we'll be back January 8th with a fresh twit. In fact, we'll be talking about CES. We'll get some people who are at CES because, believe it or not, yes, it's CES time once again. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2300 UTC. If you want to join us live on the stream, live in studio, just email tickets at twit.tv. We love having a live studio audience. And, of course, in our chat room at irc.twit.tv. After the fact, our shows are available on demand at twit.tv, on youtube.com/twit. And, of course, everywhere you get podcasts, we have audio and video for you. And it would be great. It would make me very happy if you would subscribe, because I tell you what, the show is interesting every week. And it, I know it's long, but you can take your time listening to it if you download it and listen. Thank you for being here. Have a great holiday. Happy New Year. And I'll see you January 8th. Another Twit
this is in the camp.
Amazing. Bye-bye.